Which is available for anyone taking a PhD in this department. Some of you may well be in that position. If you're not, well, I imagine you're not going to be too disappointed if you don't get to cover all the gravity wave stuff. And secondly, by getting through Chapter 5 a bit more quickly, it will leave more time to do more on black holes and on cosmology, which is Chapter 6 and 7. So I would anticipate that between this lecture and the lecture on Monday, always assuming health hasn't got worse, but as I say, I just can't seem to shake this cough off, but at least it's not confined me too much to bed over the course of the week. So I fully expect to be here at 4 o'clock on Monday as well. That should see us through to the end of Chapter 4 and a good way into Chapter 5 as well. And that will leave 4 further lectures, 8, 9, 10 and 11, to cover the final 2 chapters. Okay? So what's Chapter 4 all about? Well, we're about to see. And what we're going to do in this chapter is we're going to look at what goes on inside a star, seen from the point of view of general relativity. So our focus in Chapter 3 was to look at the metric exterior to a star. We treated a star as a point mass, and we worked out all sorts of interesting phenomena that general relativity predict for such a metric. We call it the Schwarzschild metric. Now we're going to look at the inside of the star, so the solution is not going to be the Schwarzschild metric, but we're going to see what the solution leads to by way of predictions for the internal physical characteristics of a star. Now, for those of you, just most, but not all, who've done some astronomy before, ideas of stellar structure are actually first met in first year, where the astronomers in the first year course meet the concept of hydrostatic equilibrium. Now, I'm going to put you on the spot and see if you can remember the details of that, but has everyone at least heard of that, even if you haven't met it in... Well, I know the astronomers are going to nod their heads, that's good, but just a mindful, we've got a few folks here doing theoretical physics and so on. Right, well, that's good. As I say, I will not assume too much by way of your prior knowledge, but really the goal here, a bit like what we did in Chapter 3, is to see what difference GR makes. We want to compare the solution for the internal structure of a star in the Newtonian case and in the GR case. So the Newtonian case is obtained by using the equation of hydrostatic equilibrium to tell you how the pressure inside a star varies with the radius from the centre. And our main goal is to derive the same result, but for GR, and we'll see how it's different. Okay? So as it says at the bottom, we'll investigate how GR effects change the internal structure of a star, which according to Newtonian theory can be well described by hydrostatic equilibrium. So, we're assuming that the star is spherically symmetric and it's static. So actually, we can start off the same place we started off in Chapter 3. Because before we derive the Schwarzschild metric, we first of all derive the equations of a spherically symmetric static spacetime. And then to get the Schwarzschild metric, what we did was we assumed certain boundary conditions. We said that the components of the Ricci tensor should be zero for everywhere outside the star. Well, that's not going to be true anymore because we're considering inside the star. But if we want our star to be spherically symmetric and static, then our starting point should be the same. It should be equation 4.1, which also was equation 223, before we even got on to the test of the Schwarzschild metric, okay? So we're still in the situation where we've got a function nu and a function lambda, which depend on the radial coordinate, but they don't depend on anything else. Because if they did, then the star wouldn't be spherically symmetric and it wouldn't be static. Okay? Therefore, all we've got to do is work out what, in this case, the functions nu and lambda are. We derived what they were for the Schwarzschild metric under certain boundary conditions. They're going to be different in this case because the boundary conditions are different. We're inside a star. Okay? So that's the basic idea. So let's see what those boundary conditions are. Might be. Well, our starting point is actually again the same. We look to the components of the Ricci tensor. And I remind you of what I said in chapter 2, that I wouldn't expect you to remember those. Certainly not, they're pretty horrid. Fairly easy to crank through from the Riemann-Christoffel tensor, but, you know, sooner or later in an exam situation, your eyes would just start to glaze over. It's not realistic to expect you to either derive them or certainly not to remember them. So you would be given those. The task now is to see, well, what can we do with them? Okay. So equations 4.6 to 4.9 are just raising the indices of the G components, the components of the metric. We'll see in a moment why we need that. Because the metric's orthogonal, then G lower index TT is just 1 over G upper index TT. And the same conditions basically apply for the others. So we'll have to use those in a few minutes. Okay, so the next page works through a bunch of equations that we sort of basically put together to derive the Einstein tensor. Remember, this is the tensor that sort of describes the curvature of space-time, and Einstein's equations equate that to the energy-momentum tensor. That's really just the tensorial way of saying, you know, space-time tells matter how to move, matter tells space-time how to curve. So there's nothing very profound going on here, it's just lots of algebra. Bit messy, but, you know, doable. So in particular, the contraction of the Ricci tensor, which is the Ricci scalar, is what you get when you contract R mu nu with the contravariant components of the metric tensor, G mu nu. So because mu's appear and nu's appear in the upper and lower, then that means that you've got a sum. And instead of it being 16 terms you're summing over, it's only 4 because it's an orthogonal metric. So all the off-diagonal terms of the metric are 0. So that's why you only wind up with GTT, GRR, G theta theta, G phi phi. In actual fact, the Ricci tensor components are 0 as well when you're off-diagonal. So they'd all be 0 anyway. So we put all that together. We get an expression for the Ricci scalar. That gets plugged into the Einstein tensor, which in the end gives us these four equations, 4.13 to 4.16. So now we've got to decide what to do with them. Well, remember, Einstein's equations equate the Einstein tensor to the energy-momentum tensor. Now, in the case where you're in empty space, we can set the energy-momentum tensor to be zero. But now we're inside a star, therefore T mu nu isn't going to be zero. But our ultimate goal will be the same. It will be to work out what T mu nu is and then equate those components to the Einstein tensor components, and then we work out what metric that gives us. So what's T mu nu going to be? Well, to keep our life as simple as we can, we assume that the star is a perfect fluid. So a perfect fluid is a description of the interior structure of the star that treats the material the star's made of as a continuous field, and we ignore any shearing forces, so the fluid elements aren't sort of like sliding across each other. There is pressure inside the fluid elements, but there's no shearing, there's no twisting. And dust is a special case of a perfect fluid in which there's no pressure. But we don't really want to make that assumption here. We're talking about a star. You expect that there's going to be pressure inside the star, because basically the star's a hot gas, and when the gas is moving around, classically, that gives rise to pressure. We still expect that to be true in the relativistic case. So the model that we want for the components of the energy-momentum tensor, well, actually, it was one that really Norman would have derived, but I reminded you of it in the review chapter 132 that we just really skimmed over very quickly. But that equation there, 132, I've reproduced as 417, and it's the components of the energy momentum tensor in upper index or contravariant form, and U, or U mu if you like, if we express it in component form, that's the four velocity of a fluid element. Okay? So, I mean, you might have forgotten that from semester one, but there's nothing really new I've introduced there. That's just the same definition of the energy momentum tensor that Norman was using. Okay, and rho and P are the density, strictly speaking, the mass energy density, because we're thinking of both matter and energy as sources for the energy momentum tensor. And P is the pressure. U is the four velocity, like I said. Now, we're looking for a static solution. We're trying to find a solution to the star that isn't pulsating or anything complicated like that. We're doing just the same as the classical treatment that the astros have had a couple of times already, whereby you treat the star as static. So in GR, that means that the UR, U theta and U phi components of the four velocity are all zero. Whether you express them in upper index or lower index form, they're still zero. Okay? Now, another useful equation, 128, which is really actually just another way of writing the geodesic equation, that what we've got is GTT times UT squared has to equal minus 1. So that tells us what UT has to be. It's got to be e to the minus nu over 2. And then with lower indices, UT has to be minus e to the nu over 2. Now that helps us a bit, because it means that our expression on the previous slide for the energy momentum tensor, because we've said that U for a static fluid element has zero components for UR, U theta and U phi, then actually that term there, the U mu, is only going to be non-zero when you're considering the T component. And then you're multiplying that by U nu, which again is only going to be non-zero when it's a T component. So we just need to consider UT, UT. But G, G mu nu, that's non-zero for the R, theta and phi components as well. So putting all that together leads to the equations that you see 421 to 424. TTT, okay, that's the TT component of the energy momentum tensor, turns out to be rho times e to the nu. TRR is P times e to the lambda. T theta theta is P times R squared, and T phi phi is PR squared sine squared theta. So the sheer volume of algebra involved is, I admit, non-trivial, but each individual step isn't really that hard, I think. That would be my hope, at least. But it's simply a matter of just substituting the right things into the right places. So what we've got ourselves then is the components of the energy momentum tensor for a perfect fluid. So unlike chapter 3, or really it was chapter 2 when we derived the Schwarzschild metric, unlike that point where we assumed that the energy momentum tensor was zero, we're not going to assume that it's zero, because space isn't empty inside the star. There's matter, and that matter's got pressure. So these terms, excuse me, these terms are going to be non-zero. Alright, you're with me so far. Essentially all we're doing is the same thing we always do when we try to solve Einstein's equations. The only thing that differs from one case to the next is what is the energy momentum tensor. So we've derived it for a perfect fluid, for a static spherically symmetric star. Later in the course, we'll derive it for the universe. Well, we'll derive Einstein's equations when you try to describe the whole universe, and that will lead to a different metric, but see, that lies ahead. For now, we're just going to use g mu nu is 8 pi t mu nu. Remind you again that that's assuming g, the gravitational constant, equals 1, and also assuming the speed of light equals 1. And that is going to be the basis for us solving Einstein's equations. So we've got ourselves the right-hand side terms, what the energy momentum tensor components are. And we'd previously worked out, or I had flashed before you the means to work out, the components of the Einstein tensor. So now all we've got to do is match them up. Then, okay, easier said than done, but it's just a bit of algebra, and that gives us 426, 427, 428. We don't really get any extra information out of the phi phi component, because that's just the same as the theta theta one multiplied by sine squared theta. Similar, I suppose the technical term would be degeneracy, a similar degeneracy to what we saw in the earlier chapter as well. So that's us, we've got ourselves some equations to solve. So starting off from Einstein's equations and putting in what the energy momentum tensor is in this particular case, we've now got ourselves some equations that we need to solve. And if we solve them, it will tell us what the metric is for the interior structure of the star. Okay? So let's look at the first one. Excuse me. So the first thing to notice is from 426, we can cancel e to the nu from both sides. Okay? So that then means that we can take the r squared up to give us 8 pi rho r squared. And a little bit of reverse engineering, if you look at the left hand side of 429 and differentiate it, then you'll see that it actually gets you back to 426. So the first Einstein equation can be rewritten as d by dr of r times 1 minus e to the minus lambda, that all equals 8 pi rho r squared. Now, before we solve that, we're going to do something that looks a bit odd at first. We're going to introduce a new function, dm by dr, which will equate to 4 pi rho times r squared. Now, in a Newtonian context, dm we can think of as the mass contained within a thin shell of radius r. Okay, and those of you who've done the stellar physics course will probably have seen that same calculation, but of course in a wholly classical context, no gr, but you use the same result. Dm by dr is 4 pi rho times r squared. So what we associate with dm in that case would be the mass contained within a thin shell of radius r. So m of r is, for that reason, also referred to as the mass function. But all I would add is that in gr, you've got to be a wee bit more careful what you mean by mass, because that depends what rest frame you're in, or depends what frame you're in, I'm sorry. If you're in the rest frame of the fluid element, then you'll measure the rest mass. If you're in another frame, then there'll also be a substantial momentum component to the material. So that's not really a problem. It'll all sort itself out. We're perfectly at liberty to define this thing that we call dm by dr and say that it's equal to 4 pi rho r squared. The thing that we're not really allowed to do is to immediately associate m with the mass contained within a shell, because we'd have to be more precise as to what we mean by mass. We'd have to see which frame we're in order to define that. Okay? So for now, we'll call it the mass function, but we shouldn't jump immediately to associating it with the Newtonian description. But nonetheless, we'll see that it's still useful to help us solving the equation. Because we've already got 431, that we can write that this d by dr expression is equal to 2 dm by dr. So if we integrate that equation, well, maybe I should just let you see it again to see what I'm up to. We've got that d by dr of something is equal to d by dr of 2 times m, where m isn't a constant, it's a function. But if we've got two things, two sides of the equation which are both differentiated with respect to R, then the two things that are being differentiated have to be equal to each other as well, plus some arbitrary integration constant. So that's what's going on here. We can see that R times 1 minus e to the minus lambda equals 2m plus a constant c. Okay? And we set c equal to 0 unless the star is singular at r equals 0. That means to say that we assume that when r equals 0, m equals 0. Okay? Now, black holes might run contrary to that, but we'll get onto black holes in a later chapter. We're not worrying about black holes just yet. So what this leads us to conclude is that e to the minus lambda is just 1 minus 2m over r. That looks suspiciously like what we had for the Schwarzschild metric. But there is a key difference. The e to the minus lambda term we had for the Schwarzschild metric was 1 minus 2 capital M over r. All right, it's a capital letter. What's the big deal? But that was the total mass of the star. Whereas here we're inside. So we've got to be careful. We're not talking about the total mass of the star. Okay? For the interior metric, m isn't a constant, but it's a function of coordinate radius, and we haven't worked out what that function is yet. But we will. Okay? But it's kind of reassuring that we've got an equation that looks suspiciously similar to what we had for the Schwarzschild metric. So we must be kind of doing something right. Okay? So the next equation we get by rearranging the second of the Einstein equations. So we've done something with the first one, 426. We've still not solved it because we haven't worked out what m is as a function of r. But we've got somewhere. Now we'll switch attention to the second one. Okay? So let's see what we can do with that. Equation 427. Bit of rearrangement. And the immortal phrase, some straightforward algebra. It really isn't that bad. You wind up with the expression you see there. D nu by dr equals e to the lambda into 8 pi times the pressure p times r plus 1 over r into 1 minus e to the minus lambda. So now what we can do is exploit the progress we made with the first Einstein equation, which established that e to the minus lambda was 1 minus 2m over r. So we might as well now substitute that in. And when you do, 434 simplifies a little bit. And we get 1 minus 2m over r all to the minus 1 times 8 pi pr plus 2m over r squared. Or we can rewrite that as the rightmost term in 435. Okay? So we've got a differential equation for nu as a function of coordinate radius. So it's kind of basically telling us how nu changes as you move out inside the star. That's encouraging. It's also, apparently, got something to do with this function m, which is maybe or maybe not got something to do with the mass. At least it does in the Newtonian limit. We have to be careful how we interpret it in GR. But there's the pressure. So we've got something that maybe might wind up looking like the hydrostatic equilibrium expression, because that's to do with how pressure changes with radius. So that's kind of where we're headed. Now the third of the Einstein equations, 428, we could try to solve that. We could substitute in for d nu by dr, because notice there's some nu dashes there, that's what that means. We could substitute in for for lambda, and for e to the minus lambda. But there's another way to go, which is to use the geodesic equation. And to use the fact that mass energy is conserved. T mu nu semicolon nu is equal to zero. That's the covariant derivative of the energy momentum tensor contracted over one of its indices equals zero. That's the GR way of saying that energy and momentum are conserved, which is still true in GR just as it is in classical physics. So that's what we're going to use. That's the result we're going to use, beginning on page 68. Okay, so T alpha beta semicolon beta equals zero. I'm not sure if I've mentioned before, in one of these weeks I'll maybe actually wear the sweatshirt, but when I was AstroSoc secretary, when we were in final year, somehow we thought it was a good idea to get some sweatshirts printed with T alpha beta semicolon beta vanishes on it. I think we actually made it mu nu, not that that makes any difference. We didn't sell very many, but I've still got mine. And that is nonetheless a really key result, because it's the GR way of saying that energy and momentum is conserved. So it would seem quite appropriate to use energy momentum conservation when you're trying to model the interior structure of the star. So let's see how it winds up looking. So T alpha beta is the term inside the square brackets, and we're covariantly differentiating that, and then we're contracting by having the repeated index beta on the top and the bottom. So basically what we've got is a sum of terms that we're differentiating. Well, that's easy because it's just the sum of the derivatives, but some of them involve a product. So we've got to use the product rule for covariant differentiation. Now, I used to cover that when I taught the first half. It will be buried there somewhere in Norman's notes, but all of my notes for the first half are available as well, and so too are the example sheets. So if you want to see it explicitly worked through on an example sheet from when I used to teach the first half, then it's sheet 1-5. So the links to that are on the web, and I'll put the model answers up as well. So equation 438, it's a bit horrid, but it's just a string of terms, which is what you get when you explicitly carry out the covariant differentiation shown in 437. Okay, so let's think through what's going on. So we've used the fact, first of all, that rho and p, the pressure and density, or density and pressure, are scalars. And the covariant derivative of a scalar is the same as its partial derivative. Okay? We only have to start worrying about this whole nasty business of covariant differentiation when we're differentiating vectors or tensors. And the reason basically is because the components of a vector or tensor vary from place to place. So the covariant derivative has to take account of that. And the way it does so is by adding on the terms involving the Christoffel symbols. The Christoffel symbols tell you how the basis vectors vary from place to place. So the Christoffel symbols tell you how the components of a vector or tensor will vary from place to place. But we don't need to worry about any of that if it's a scalar we're differentiating. So that's why the first term, it's not a typo, it's just an ordinary comma. That's just ordinary partial differentiation. All right? Quite an important point. Then we've got the next term. Remember, this is just all the chain rule. So that's, we say, keep the first term constant, rho plus p. Differentiate the second one, u alpha covariantly differentiated, multiplied by the third. And then the next term after that is where you keep the first and second term fixed and covariantly differentiate the third. So it's just the chain rule, just as you've been using for years, but just presented in a slightly more unusual way because of all the funny notation. Then you've got two further terms, because of course the second term in the square brackets of 437 is the product of a scalar and a tensor. So the scalar, when it's covariantly differentiated, is just a partial derivative. And then when you differentiate the tensor, well, it's not any old tensor, it's the metric tensor. And the covariant derivatives of the metric are zero. This is almost kind of hardwired into the way that you define the covariant derivative, that the metric components are going to be zero. So we haven't used that yet, but we will a bit later. Okay, so the wee bit of blurb just below equation 438 is what I've really just been saying. Notice, of course, that we've done all this for beta, and we haven't said what beta is. It could be time, It could be r, it could be theta, it could be phi. So it's actually a set of equations. Okay? You're summing over beta, but then alpha is a free index. So as I've said at the bottom, beta could be all of r, theta, t and phi, and then alpha can be as well. So you've got a set of four equations where alpha varies and then beta is summed over. But we're only going to consider one of them. We're going to consider the equation where alpha is representing r. So equation 439, which once again looks rather hideous, but on closer inspection is really just the same as 438, where all the alphas have been replaced by r's because we're specifically selecting out that one of the four equations. Alright? So let's see if there's anything we can do with those. Well, remember I said that the solution we're seeking is a static one. So we assume that the r, theta and phi component of the four velocity are zero. So if we look at that first term, because we're selecting the r equation, then we've got a ur there. So that's going to be zero. So that first term goes away if we want a static solution. The same thing goes for the third term. We've got a ur. That'll be zero for a static solution. The fifth term vanishes because the covariant derivatives of the metric are all zero. That's another result which I used to derive when I taught GR1. So it's all there if you want to consult my notes, but it'll be buried there within Norman's as well. Now in the second term, we've got a sum over beta. So only the t component's non-zero because ur, u theta and u phi are all zero. But notice that even though ur is zero, it doesn't necessarily follow that its covariant derivative is zero. Okay? Because it's just a component of a vector. It's not a scalar. So it's not zero. I suppose what I really mean is that if you transform to a different coordinate system, then the components would move, you know, the contribution to each component would move from one coordinate to another. Therefore, we can't assume that in general that this term ur semicolon beta is going to be zero. Okay? We've got a gr beta term, and remember we're summing over beta. But because it's an orthogonal metric, that's only going to be non-zero when beta equals r. So there's a lot of staring at this equation you're probably going to have to do just to make sure that you've followed the various arguments I've just described. But the very general form of that equation can be rendered into a slightly simpler form using the fact that you've got a static star, using the fact that the covariant derivatives of the metric are zero, and using the fact that you've got an orthogonal metric. Those three facts all together give you equation 440, which looks a bit more manageable. So it involves dp by dr. Okay, now to see where that came from, it's coming about because we've got p semicolon beta, and gr beta is equal to zero unless beta equals r, so we get dp by dr. And if you're really sharp-eyed, you might say, but wait a minute, should that not be a partial derivative? Well, technically it should, but because it's a static spherically symmetric star, the pressure can only vary with respect to r. So we might as well just write it as a total derivative. Okay? It's only a kind of nitpicky thing anyway, but actually last time I taught this course, one of the fifth years did come up and said, shouldn't that be a partial derivative? And of course they were quite right, but the reason we've made it a total derivative is really the same reason in a classical treatment you would derive the hydrostatic equilibrium with a total derivative dp by dr. It's because you're assuming it's a static spherical symmetric star. So what else is it going to vary with respect to? It can only vary with respect to r. Okay? The covariant derivative of ur, because remember that's different, covariant derivatives are different from partial derivatives. Although it's a static spherically symmetric star, we're taking a covariant derivative which involves asking ourselves how the components of vectors and tensors will look from different places in a coordinate system, different times in a coordinate system. So we can't instantly say that because it's a static star that left-hand side is going to vanish, but we can, on the other hand, say that the first term on the right-hand side will vanish, because that's a partial derivative. So partial derivatives with respect to time, they're zero, but covariant derivatives aren't necessarily. So what we get is that the covariant derivative just winds up equal to this Christoffel symbol, and the only term that we need care about is the J equals T, because the components of our four velocity are zero for R, theta and phi, because it's static and spherically symmetric. So we get U semicolon T, the R component of that four vector. In fact, it's not a vector anymore, it's a 1-1 tensor, because we're covariantly differentiating it. We can do a bit of substitution, because we know, if you go back to chapter 2, we derived these, we know what the Christoffel symbols are for a spherically symmetric static space-time with an orthogonal metric. There's little expressions that we use to help us derive the Schwarzschild metric. We're just going to use those same expressions to now derive what's going on inside a star instead of outside a star. Bit more algebra to be done. What it boils down to is equation 444. D nu by dr is minus 2 over rho plus p dp by dr. And if we backtrack a bit, what we got when we solved the second Einstein equation was an expression for d nu by dr. And now what we've learned is that we can rewrite that in terms of dp by dr. And the reason we would wish to is that the classical hydrostatic equilibrium equation is one for dp by dr. So let's do that and then see how different they are. Okay? So that's what we do. We get 445, which is known as the Oppenheimer-Volkov equation. And it's the general relativity equivalent of hydrostatic equilibrium. We've made the same general assumptions. We've assumed that our star is spherically symmetric and static, but we've done it within a GR framework instead of assuming just Newtonian gravity. And here's what we get. We get dp by dr is minus rho plus p times 4 pi pr cubed plus m all over r into r minus 2m. Well, at first glance, you think that looks nothing like hydrostatic equilibrium. But actually, on more careful inspection, it does turn out to reduce to the Newtonian expression. So let's just look at that and then we'll stop for today. Excuse me. The first thing to say is that if you're taking the weak field limit, that means you're saying, right, general relativity is very weak, it's basically just Newtonian physics, then you would assume that the pressure is very much less than rho. Okay? And if the pressure is very much less than rho, then that would in turn imply that 4 pi p r cubed is very much less than m. Now, where I'm getting that from is that in the Newtonian case, small m corresponds to the mass in a shell. Okay? And the density of such a shell would be its mass divided by its volume. So what we'd wind up with is, if P is very much less than rho, then you can replace rho, the density, by mass divided by volume, do a bit of cross multiplying, and you wind up with 4 pi P R cubed being very much less than M. So those two are kind of equivalent. And if the weak field metric must be nearly flat, then M has to be very much less than R. Okay? Because, how do we know that? Well, remember the one result that we did get that looked very similar to the Schwarzschild case was that e to the minus lambda was 1 minus 2m over r. But if you've got Minkowski spacetime, then e to the minus lambda would just be 1. Therefore, you need m to be much less than r in the weak field limit so that it just reduces to Minkowski flat spacetime. Alright? So, what we've got then is that in the first term up here, in 445, rho is much less than p. In the second term, 4 pi p r cubed is much less than m. And in the denominator, we've got that m is much less than r. So if you put those three things together, then what you wind up with instead is that dp by dr is minus rho times m over r squared. And if we remember, as we have throughout these lectures, that we've set g equal to 1, if you put g equal g back in again rather than g equal 1, then you've got yourself the hydrostatic equilibrium expression that the astros have seen derived in Stellar and the others. Is it derived anywhere else? Can you think of another course where you've come across that? No. Well, anyway, the expression, I won't bother going through the derivation because you're not going to need it for this course anyway, but the expression is hardly worth writing on the board because it's just this one with a G stuck in front. It's identical in form to the Newtonian expression, except it was set G equal to 1. So, okay, what have we learned? We've learned that if you do the full GR derivation, then reassuringly, if you then switch GR off again by letting the field become very weak, it reduces back to the Newtonian case. Well, that's good. But what's perhaps of more interest is, if you've actually got equation 445 and you don't ignore all the terms that we chose to ignore, then what difference does it make? In other words, if the field isn't weak but is actually quite strong, then how does the interior structure of a star differ from what it would be in the Newtonian case? And don't want to start that now, so we'll start that at the beginning of the next lecture, which will be on Monday. So we'll finish off chapter 4 by solving the Oppenheimer-Volkov equation for the internal structure of a star. It'll be like a neutron star, something like that would be a good example. Okay? So thanks for putting up with my croaky voice, but